shieldcraft and spear skill, the endless learning of the crafts of slaughter. I have seen enemies screaming like wild beasts, spitting as they charge with glazed eyes, but they died like other men. And they were often the first to die, yet still the Ofhethnar scared many warriors. Some men claim that the Ofhethnar fought drunk, but so did other warriors, while Ragnar, who had adopted me, said that the wolf warriors drank the piss of horses that had been fed the mushrooms that gave a man strange dreams, and maybe he was right. Berg, sensibly, had mentioned none of that. Ragnar had feared the Ofhethnar, saying they were stronger, quicker, and more savage than other fighters, and even the Christians, who claimed they did not believe in Odin or Fenrir or Ragnarok, were frightened by the madness of the Ofhethnar. "But we are better than the Ofhethnar," I insisted. "We are the wolves of Bebbanburg, and the Ofhethnar fear us. You hear me?" I called out to the whole hall. "They fear us. Why else send the monk to lie to us? The Ofhethnar fear us." We had been lured across Britain. There was a compliment in that, though I was in no mood to appreciate it. Skoll Grimason had led an army east to Jofawick, and the only reason for that journey was to take the throne of Northumbria from Seatrigger, my son-in-law, and Skoll had taken care to make certain I was nowhere near that throne. Evidently, the Ofhethnar feared the wolves of Bebbanburg. And despite all I had tried to tell my men, I feared the Ofhethnar. And now we must ride east to meet them. Beedwulf and his squirrel rode with us. I had thought to kill him in revenge for his treachery, but the squirrel had pleaded with me, and Beedwulf, on his knees, had promised to show me a great treasure if I spared him. "What's to stop me killing you after I take the treasure?" I had asked him.
"Nothing, Lord,"
he had said. "So show me." He had led me to what I had thought was a small granary, a wooden hut raised on four stone pillars that were meant to keep rodents from entering. Beedwulf unbolted the door and climbed inside. I had followed to see dim shelves on which were stored pots, each about the size of a man's head. He took one down, placed it on a table, and used a small knife to cut through the wax that sealed the wooden lid.
"This is the only one left, Lord,"
he had said as he pulled the lid free and handed me the pot. The pot held the chopped roots of some plant mixed with a host of small brown seeds. I looked at Beedwulf in the hut's gloom. Seeds and roots.
"It's the secret of the Ofhethnar, Lord,"
he had said. I took out a handful and sniffed. It stank. "What are they?"
"Henbane, Lord."
I had let the seeds and roots fall back. Henbane was a weed, and we feared it because it could poison pigs, and pigs were valuable. "The Ofhethnar eat this?" I had asked dubiously. Beedwulf shook his head.
"I pound the mixture, Lord."
He showed me a pestle and mortar on the shelf.
"Then make an ointment of wool grease and the crushed plant."
"And Arnborg trusted you?"
"I was a herbalist in the monastery, Lord. I know things that Arnborg's folk never discovered. When his wife was sick, I cured her with celandine. You use the roots, and you must say the paternoster 10 times as you mix—"
"I don't care about celandine," I had snarled. "Tell me about the henbane."
"I made the ointment for Jarl Arnborg, Lord, and it was better than the paste Snorri made."
"Snorri?"
"Skoll's sorcerer, Lord." "He's a powerful sorcerer, Lord."
Beedwulf had made the sign of the cross when he said that.
"But he used the leaves and petals of the plant to make his ointment. The seeds and roots have more power."
"So you make an ointment?"
"And the warriors smear it on their skin, Lord."
"And what does that do?"
"The men think they can fly, Lord. They stagger, they howl. Sometimes they just fall asleep, but in battle it turns them into madmen."
I sniffed the pot again and almost retched. "Have you tried it?"
"Yes, Lord."
"And?"
"I thought I saw God, Lord. He glowed and had wings."
"You saw God, not Winfled." He had blushed.
"I am a sinner, Lord."
I gave him back the pot. "So Arnborg took seeds with him?"
"He took 4 jars of the prepared ointment, Lord."
"You have the grease?"
"Yes, Lord."
"Make me a pot," I had ordered him.
"Lord?"
he had pleaded, and waited till I nodded.
"If I stay here, Lord,"
he went on,
"Erica will kill me. She will think I brought you here."
"You did bring me here," I had said. "But if you're so scared, just go. Walk south. Take your girl."
"They'll follow me, Lord. Take us with you. I can treat the sick. Please, Lord."
I had scowled at him. "How can I trust you?"
"Do I look like a man who would offend you again, Lord?"
And that, I confess, had made me smile. Beedwulf was thoroughly cowed. It would have been easy to kill him, even satisfying, but Winfled was so pathetic, so wan and childlike, that I relented. "Make me the wolf ointment," I had told him, "and then you can ride with us." We plundered the hall for warm clothing, took all 8 horses that were still in Arnborg's stables, burned the 3 ships at the wharf, and under a pale afternoon sun went eastwards. Finan spurred his horse alongside mine. "You're such a weakling, Lord," he said.
"I am."
He grinned, turned and nodded towards Beedwulf and Winfled, who were mounted on the same horse, a big, placid grey gelding we had taken from Arnborg's stables. The squirrel sat in front, enfolded by the monk's arms. "I felt sorry for her," I said.
"That's what I meant.
Killing him would be too easy."
"So what will you do with him?"
I shrugged. "Let them both go, I suppose. I don't care what happens to them. I care about Stiora and my grandchildren." Stiora was my daughter, and sometimes I thought she should have been my son, because she was the strongest of my children. My eldest boy shared her strength, but he had become a Christian, a priest, no less, and that made him no son of mine. My second son, named Uhtred, like me, was a good warrior and a good man, but he had none of Stiora's strength of will. She had married Sigtryggr, who had once been my enemy, but was now my son-in-law and king of Northumbria, and they lived with their 2 children in the old Roman palace in Jofawick.
"Jofawick's walls are strong," Finan said, reading my thoughts.
"But to Sigtryggr and Stiora," I said, "the enemy are the Mercians, not the pagans. If Skoll comes to their gate, they'll likely invite him into the city."
"Not if he has an army with him," Finan retorted.
He glanced towards the setting sun.
"If I know Sigtryggr," he said, "then Skoll Grimason and his men are slaughtered by now."
He saw he had not convinced me.
"If 200 or 300 warriors turned up at the Skoll Gate at Bebbanburg, would you let them in?"
"Of course not."
"And you think Sigtryggr would?"
I touched the hammer hanging at my neck and prayed he was right. We spent that night in the remnants of the Roman fort at Ribblecaster, a fort that had guarded the ford where the road that led north to Caer Ligwalid across the Ribble. I'd thought that some of the Danes or Norse who had fled to this wild country would have taken the fort for themselves, but it was deserted. Nothing but weather-worn turf walls and the rotted stumps of an ancient palisade.
"They fear the place, Lord,"
Beedwulf told me.
"They believe it is a haunt of ghosts."
He crossed himself.
"So you're still a Christian?" I asked sourly.
"Of course, Lord."
He frowned uncertainly.
"It's just that the monastic life..."
He shrugged, evidently lost for words. "Only lets you hump other monks," I finished for him.
"Please, Lord,"
he protested, blushing. So what will your abbot do when he finds you've broken your vows?
If he finds me, Lord, he'll beat me.
I just hope Winfled is worth the beating, I said.
Oh, she is, Lord, she is.
We had ridden from Arnborg's home through good farm country, but we had seen few people, and those we did see were old, children or women, which was hardly surprising if most of the men of fighting age had followed Skoal Grimason eastwards. The first few steadings we had passed all belonged to Arnborg's men, who I assumed were now somewhere close to Jofawick. I touched the hammer again, praying they were not in the city that lay some 3 or 4 days' journey across the high moors. It was a cold night. We cut wood, mostly alder and birch, and used it for fires, confident that the fighting men of the district were far away. We had stripped Arnborg's hall of pelts, fleeces, even woolen rags, anything that might keep us warm. I placed sentries who gazed into the frost-bright night beneath a star-filled sky. The few high clouds were drifting southwards, and the next day promised to be dry, cold, and hard. We had 2 ways to reach Jofawick. The easiest route, and the longest, was to follow the good Roman road south to Manchester, then take another Roman road that went north-east and led straight to Seatrigger's city. The shorter route also followed Roman roads, but one of Arnborg's slaves, a sullen Saxon who had driven cattle across the moors, told us the road was decayed.
"You can get lost up there, Lord," he had warned me. "There are places the road is washed out, it's hard to follow."
Nevertheless, I was determined to use the shorter route. I needed to reach Jofawick swiftly, needed to discover what had happened in eastern Northumbria. Perhaps Skoal Grimason had not ridden to Jofawick, but had gone to Bevanburg instead. I only had Beedwulf's word for where Arnborg had gone. "Wasn't he worried you'd betray him?" I asked Beedwulf in the heart of that freezing night.
"He was holding Winfled as a hostage, Lord,"
I grimaced. "The power of women."
"Besides, Lord," he went on, "I only discovered what they planned when I returned. When I came to you, I still believed what Arnborg had told me, that Prince Æthelstan was under siege."
"And Arnborg paid Prince Æthelstan tribute?" I said.
"He did once, Lord."
But the Danes and the Norse, who lived in the western wilds of Cumberland, had seen Mercia weakened by rebellion, and they, like Seatrigger, had been living under the fear of a Saxon invasion. The Mercian rebellion had encouraged them to break free. "Why didn't they just ally with Seatrigger?" I asked. "He fears the Saxons as much as they do."
"They believe he is weak, Lord."
I laughed at that.
"Seatrigger, he's not weak." "They call him a client king, Lord."
"Client to who?"
"To the Christians."
"Christians? He's a pagan like me."
"But Jofawick is filled with Christians, Lord, and the Archbishop is there, and he's a Saxon."
"Hrothweird is a good man," I said grudgingly.
"Snorri says that the Archbishop has ensorcelled Seatrigger, Lord."
"Ensorcelled?"
"Used magic spells to make Seatrigger obedient, Lord, and Jarl Arnborg says there are too many Saxon Christians in Northumbria, Lord. He fears they would fight for Mercia if it came to war, and King Seatrigger is blinded to the danger."
I shook my head. "Jofawick is a Christian city, and Seatrigger rules there. He needs the Christians, he tolerates them, and he tries hard not to make enemies of them." I turned and looked back into the firelit fort. "Most of my men are Christians. What am I supposed to do, slaughter them?"
"Skoal Grimason believes Northumbria needs a stronger king, Lord,"
Beedwulf had finished. So once again I was fighting for the Christians. I would have laughed if I had not been so fearful for Jofawick's fate. Everything Beedwulf told me that night made sense. The Danes in Mercia had succumbed to the Saxons, many of them becoming Christians, just as the conquered Danes in East Anglia had converted. Mercia might be troubled by rebellion, but it was plain to anyone that the Saxons wanted to invade Northumbria when the rebels were defeated. They were making King Alfred's dream come true. When I was a child, the land that would become Inglaland had been divided into four kingdoms, Northumbria, East Anglia, Mercia, and Wessex. Four kingdoms and four kings. The Danes had invaded. They had taken Northumbria, taken East Anglia, taken all of Northern Mercia, and very nearly subjugated Wessex. But the Saxons had fought back. I had fought back, at times reluctantly, fighting to make Alfred's dream of one Saxon kingdom come true, and the realization of that dream was so close now. The West Saxons had already invaded East Anglia and made it part of their kingdom, and now Edward, Anglorum Saxonum Rex, was binding Mercia to the West Saxon throne. Only Northumbria was left. It was the last pagan kingdom in Inglaland. And the Norse, the fierce Norse, were making Cumberland their new home. No man fights the Norse willingly. But their weakness is that they rarely unite. They follow their chieftains, and when those chieftains quarrel, they fight each other. And those divisions had led to defeat in Ireland and to savage combats along the western coast of Scotland. And so the losers sailed in their dragon boats to Cumberland, the last refuge in Britain. And now a new leader had appeared, Skoll Grimason, who had performed the miracle of uniting the Norse warbands and was seeking his own kingdom. My kingdom, Northumbria. "I should have taken the throne of Northumbria," I grumbled to Finnan next morning. "Yes, Lord, you should. Why didn't you?" "I never wanted to be a king." "And if you had been king," he asked, "what would you have done?" "I'd have hammered those Norsemen into obedience for a start," I said, though in truth I was talking nonsense. If Sea Trigger had taken men west into Cumberland, then either the Mercians or the Scots would have attacked Eofowick in the east, and so long as he defended the east, so long would the western part of his kingdom stay lawless. "You don't win wars by defending," I said, "and if Northumbria is to stay free, then it needs to attack." But that was a notion as wispy as the high, thin clouds that were being driven away by a brisk wind, and behind those wispy clouds was a wall of dark, tumultuous cloud that promised snow. It was still bitterly cold. The horses' hooves shattered ice at the river's edge when we took them to the ford to drink, while the turf on which we had tried to sleep was frost-hard. Soon after dawn we loaded the pack-horses, saddled the stallions, and left the smoking ashes of our campfires behind. I wanted to hurry, but dared not, because we had few spare horses, and could not risk losing any to a broken leg, and the Roman road was now little more than a trace of half-buried stones in the frost-pale turf of the hills. Our breath misted, and the small streams were frozen. The scouts, mounted on our swiftest stallions, rode ahead, and it was those scouts who first saw the approaching horsemen. It was mid-afternoon. The sky was covered in dark cloud, and every few minutes there were spatters of sleet, though the threatened hard fall of snow had not yet arrived. The road, laid arrogantly straight across the flank of a hill, ignoring spurs and streams, had climbed all day, and we were now in bare, bleak moorland, still climbing, but I saw that our furthest scouts, maybe a mile ahead, had dismounted and were keeping below the skyline of a high spur. That told me there were other men even further ahead, men who would have seen our scouts outlined against the grey winter sky if those scouts had not been so cautious. Then one of those far scouts hauled himself into his saddle, turned his horse, and spurred back towards us. "Trouble," Finnan grunted. There were no steadings this high on the moors. In summer sheep and goats might be brought here to graze, but in winter the land was empty, and so it was unlikely that any merchants would be travelling this broken road across the moors.
"It must be men coming back from Jofawick," I suggested.
"Defeated men, I hope," Finnan said. He and I had hurried ahead to meet the scout, Kettle, curbing our horses where some yards of the road had long ago been washed away by a sudden flood. Kettle slowed as he neared us, and let his horse pick its way across the slope.
"Men, Lord," he said, "maybe 200. Some on the road, some are driving cattle in the valley."
The valley was a wide, boggy swale to our left. "How far away?"
"A good mile beyond that crest, Lord, and they're coming slow because of the cattle."
Any cattle captured at this time of year would have been taken from byres or barns, not from the fields. The herds had been slaughtered at the beginning of winter, with just enough beasts left safe behind walls to breed for the new year, so the approaching men must have raided Seatrigger's land, maybe my land too, and had doubtless stolen cattle, silver and slaves, and were now bringing their spoils home. The presence of the cattle, indeed of the men themselves, suggested they had failed to capture Jofawick. Why else would they be coming west across the hills instead of staying in the city?
"Just 200 men?" Finnan asked.
"So far," Kettle said, "but more were still coming when I left."
"Scouts?" I asked.
"None, Lord,"
Kettle spat.
"Reckon they feel safe without them. There's enough of the bastards."
"We'll go south," I said bleakly. "We'll let them pass, but I want to capture some of the bastards too."
I would have preferred to go north because the land there was more rugged, promising more hiding places, but the valley immediately to our north was wide, and I reckoned it would take too much time to reach the far crest, time in which the approaching enemy might see us, while the southern skyline was much closer. I stood in my stirrups, pointed south, and the far scouts, who had already started back towards us, saw my gesture and changed direction. Then I led my men over the hill, and once hidden from the road, dismounted. I lay on the crest, waiting, watching and shivering. A hard fall of rain swept the valley. It was no longer sleet, so perhaps it was warmer, though I felt chilled to the marrow. The wind gusted, died, and gusted again, billowing the great veils of rain. The hard rain stopped, and for a while there was nothing to see except a pair of curlews above the empty valley and a buzzard drifting south on the uncertain wind. Was that an omen? During the night I had woken, cold and shivering, with the memory of a dream fresh in my mind. I had been steering a ship along a strange shore, looking for a safe harbour and finding none, and I had tried to see the message in that dream, but I could find nothing ominous in the dream ship or the placid shore. The gods do talk to us in our dreams, just as the flight of birds can reveal their wishes, but it seemed the gods were not talking to me. The buzzard flew out of sight. I wanted a reassurance from the gods, and I was finding none.
"There," Finnan said beside me,
and I saw the first horsemen appear on the eastern crest. And so they came, horseman after horseman, and in the wide valley to their north were straggling lines of cattle herded by boys.
"Christ," Finnan said, "there's more than 200 of the bastards."
Some men were on foot, while others guarded the women and children who had been captured. Those women would mostly be sold as slaves, though doubtless some would find new husbands among the Norse. I gestured Beedwulf to join us, snarling at him to crawl the last few paces so his head did not show above the skyline.
"Tell me if you see Skoll," I ordered him.
"I've never seen him, Lord."
He saw the anger on my face.
"But they say he is a big man, and that he wears a cloak of white fur."
For a time we lay in silence, just watching the folk trudge along the road. I counted over 300 men before Beedwulf made a nervous sound.
"There, Lord,"
he said, his eyes widening as he watched a knot of horsemen, perhaps 40 or 50 strong, appear beneath us. "There what?"
"That must be Skoll Grimmarsson," he said.
speaking softly, as though he feared the Far Horseman could hear us.
"The man in the white bear fur, Lord," he added.
And there, riding alone at the centre of the horsemen, was a big man on a big horse, wearing a big cloak of pure white fur. I had heard of the white bears, though I had never seen one. But travellers said that in the far north, where the snow never melts, and where even in summer the sea is ice-locked, there are massive bears with thick white pelts. I would never have believed such stories had I not once seen such a pelt for sale in London, though at a price that only a king could afford. Most of the men riding with Skoll wore grey cloaks. Wolf pelts? Were those men, I wondered, the feared Ulfhjethna?
"And that's his sorcerer, Lord,"
Beedwulf was whispering.
"Snorri."
He did not need to point out the sorcerer, who had long white hair and wore a long white robe beneath a cloak of dark fur. I instinctively touched my hammer amulet.
"He's blind, Lord,"
Beedwulf said. "The sorcerer?"
"They say Skoll blinded him with a red-hot sword tip, Lord."
"Jesus," Finan muttered in disgust. But it made sense to me. We know that Odin's great wisdom came at the price of an eye, so Skoll had made his sorcerer pay double the price to endow him with even more knowledge.
"Men fear Snorri," Beedwulf said, "because he sees the future and he can kill with a curse."
He watched the riders beneath us.
"And I think that's Arnborg," Beedwulf went on. "The man on the roan horse, Lord. I think that's him. It looks like his horse."
The roan horse was some 20 paces behind Skoll and his sorcerer, but the rider was too far away for me to make out his face. He wore a helmet, a sword hung by his side, and a great dark cloak covered his horse's rump. Like most of the passing riders, he slumped in his saddle, plainly weary, and I was tempted to tell my men to mount, then charge across the crest and wreak havoc on the horsemen below. Kill the leaders, I thought, and the rest of the Norsemen would be discouraged. It was a risk. I might lose some horses to broken legs, and perhaps the Norsemen were not as tired as they appeared, and I was still weighing the dangers of such an attack when even more riders appeared.
"God in his heaven," Finan said. "But how many are there?"
There must have been at least 60 horsemen following Skoll's group. They were not quite the last, because a quarter mile or so behind came a straggling bunch of women and children, guarded by 9 horsemen. Some of the women limped, others were carrying small children, while the riders were using spears to goad the captured slaves, who numbered some 30 or 40. "I want prisoners," I said, and looked at Finan. "Tell the Christians to hide their crosses." Finan hesitated, as if tempted to warn me against trying something rash, then abruptly nodded and wriggled back downhill.
"What will you do, Lord?"
Beedwulf asked me nervously.
"I need prisoners," I said. "I need to know what happened at Jofawick."
Did I really need to know? The appearance of the Norsemen suggested they had failed, and that was surely news enough. Yet I wanted to know more. I wanted to know the full story of their failure. So I would take prisoners. I looked westwards. The road crossed a lower spur some half a mile away, and then dropped out of sight. If I timed my approach right, then Skoll and his men would not see what was happening behind them. And if they did, it would take them time to return and fight us. Time enough for us to retreat, and I doubted they would want to pursue us far into the waning afternoon. Behind me, my men were mounting their horses. I went back and joined them, pulling myself into Tintrig's saddle.
"Rorik," I called, "you have that flag we took from Arnborg's hall?"
"Of course, Lord."
"Put it on our staff."
One of our pack horses carried my wolf's head banner on a pole, and Rorik now untied that flag and laced on the captured banner. I did not want to charge recklessly down the hill, and so risk breaking a horse's leg, but if we went slowly, then the few men guarding the prisoners might send a warning to the warriors ahead. A familiar banner would reassure them that they had no need to raise the alarm. Or so I hoped. And, I thought, if I took just a handful of men, then the ruse would be even more convincing.
"Berg," I called, "choose 8 men.
"Eight?"
"Just 8. All of them Norsemen or Danes. Rorik, bring the flag."
"What about me?" Fernand asked, reluctant to be left out of any fighting.
"I need you up here. Wait till we've captured the bastards, then show yourself if you need to."
Finan was the only man I trusted to understand what I planned. If it all went wrong, if Skoll Grimason turned around and threatened us, then the sight of almost 100 warriors on a hill crest might give him pause. It seemed he had failed to capture Jofawick, so why would he want to lose more men? Warriors were valuable, even more valuable than the cattle and slaves he was driving westwards.
"We go slowly," I told Berg. "No shields. I want them to think we're scouts returning to the road."
"They didn't have scouts, Lord,"
Berg pointed out.
"Maybe these men at the rear don't know that," I said, then nudged Tintrig up the slope and saw that the larger mass of horsemen had disappeared across the western crest,
while the small group of prisoners, guarded by the 9 horsemen, were alone on the road.
"Let's go," I said. And so we walked the horses up the slope and then along the skyline. The wind blew harder, but our captured flag was heavy with rainwater and did not unfurl, and so I ordered Rorik to wave the staff. One of the horsemen below looked up. I watched the man, but he showed no alarm. Scouts normally carry no flags because they do not want to be noticed, but the horseman who stared up at us appeared to see nothing strange. He did not spur his horse ahead, but just looked away and kept the same slow pace, and so we angled down the hill.
"You and I get ahead of them," I told Berg, knowing the other 8 men, 4 of them Norsemen and 4 Danes, were listening.
"The rest of you follow the captives. Don't alarm their guards. We're all friends."
Henkil Herethson laughed. He was a Danish Christian, a rarity in Northumbria, who had served in my cousin's garrison at Bebbanburg. He had fought us there, but had sworn allegiance to me and had proved himself loyal. He liked to fight with a double-bladed axe that now hung at his saddle. I noticed that his cross was hidden.
"Don't draw swords," I went on, "till I beckon you. Then ride alongside them and watch to see when I draw serpent breath. That's when you attack. And I want prisoners. 2 prisoners at least. And Rorik..."
The boy grinned, knowing what I was about to say.
"I'm to stay out of the fight, Lord?"
"You're to stay out of the fight."
The enemy plainly suspected nothing because they had paused, waiting for us. We reached the road and spurred towards them as the prisoners collapsed at the road's edge. I could hear a child crying and saw one of the mounted men smack the infant's mother across the head with his spear shaft.
"It is a horrible noise,"
Berg remarked to me.
"You'll hear it often enough," I said. "Is Hannah pregnant yet?"
"She might be, Lord. We try hard enough."
I laughed, then held up a hand to check the men following us.
They curbed their horses just a few paces from the rearmost enemy, while Berg and I went on.
I nodded companionably to the nearest spearman and spurred Tintrig on past the prisoners to where a glum-looking man with drooping grey moustaches slumped in his saddle. His cloak, mail, and helmet looked better than the rest, and I assumed he was the leader.
"It's cold," I called.
"Almost lambing time," he said. "It should be warmer than this."
He frowned, perhaps realizing that he had never seen me before. Water beaded the rim of his helmet.
"You're one of Jarl Arnborg's men?"
"I'm his uncle," I said. "His father's brother."
"You were at Jorvik?"
"We were too late," I said. "We just came from Ireland." "Folkmar," I introduced myself.
"Ina Eriksson," he responded.
"We should keep going," I said. "There are Saxons over that hill." I nodded south. Ina looked alarmed.
"Following us?"
just searching. They were far off and didn't see us, but keep going anyway.
He waved his men on. Some of the women cried as they were prodded with the long spears, but they stood and shambled on reluctantly.
"We should just kill them,"
Ina said, looking sourly at the prisoners.
"We have enough slaves," he grumbled. "These ones are sick and slow."
"They'll still fetch silver," I said.
"Where? Difflin has more than enough slaves already."
Difflin, I knew, was the largest Norse settlement in Ireland, and the largest slaving town in the West. Most slaves were carried to Francia or else sold in London, but those markets were far away and difficult to reach from Cumberland.
"Slaves are slaves," I said vaguely. "They're all valuable." "Then we should just kill the damn children," Ina said. "We could always give the women more."
He chuckled at that. "Why don't you?" I asked. He looked startled at that suggestion.
"If they're slowing you down," I went on, "why not just kill the little bastards?"
He grimaced.
"Young ones are valuable."
"They do make a horrible noise, though," I said. Then paused because four horsemen had appeared on the skyline ahead. Four horsemen who were spurring back towards us. "Who were they?" I asked. Ina muttered a curse, then twisted in his saddle.
"Hurry them!"
he shouted at his men, who responded by thumping their spear staves on the women's backs. I wanted to curse too. I had deliberately brought a small number down the hill, relying on surprise to give us an advantage in the fight I knew lay ahead. But now the 10 of us would face 13. I saw that all four of the approaching horsemen wore the grey wolf-pelt cloaks. Were they the Ulfhjefnar? They rode fine horses, wore bright mail beneath the belts, and had helmets crested with wolf-tails. Their leader, or at least the man at their head, rode a tall black stallion, had a long fair beard, and his helmet was chased with silver. He looked young, but he had an arrogant confidence that spoke either of noble birth or early achievement.
"If you can't keep up," he called to Einar as he came closer, "we'll abandon you. Make the bitches move faster."
"We're trying, lord," Einar answered.
"Then try harder. Kill the ugliest bitch as an example."
He reined in and frowned at me.
"Who are you?"
"Folkmar, lord," I answered humbly. He must have noted the quality of my bridle, mail and helmet.
"Where are you from? I haven't seen you before."
"The Ribble, lord."
"He's Arnborg's uncle, lord,"
Einar put in helpfully.
"Arnborg's uncle was killed at—"
the young man began, then snatched at his sword. I had already begun to draw serpent breath, and she was quicker from the scabbard than his blade, but he was fast. I swept the sword back-handed, but the young man ducked and spurred, and serpent breath cut uselessly into his wolf-tail crest. He back-handed too, his blade striking my back, but without enough force to cut the mail beneath my cloak. He was on my right, but on my left one of his companions tried to ram his horse into Tintrig. The man's sword was half-drawn as I cut serpent breath across his face, starting blood. I spurred forward, turned back to my right to see the young man in the silvered helmet was close behind. He was fast. He was good. I began a second backswing as he lunged his sword at my side, and that lunge should have pierced my mail and driven deep into my belly, and the only thing that saved me was his horse stepping on one of the big stones that edged the road. The horse staggered sideways, the young man's lunge went wide, and serpent breath struck the back of his helmet hard. The blade split the metal and cracked into bone. I had a glimpse of blood and white bone, then the young man toppled from his rich saddle. I turned Tintrig back. Another of the wolf-pelt warriors was spurring at me, sword raised to strike, and I rowled Tintrig hard and felt the battle rage. The stallion leapt forward, the man's sword came down savagely, but I had closed on him too fast and his sword arm struck my shoulder just as serpent breath skewered into his belly, breaking mail. I turned away, twisting the blade as I let Tintrig's strength tug the sword free. Ina was in front of me now. He had drawn his sword, but seemed frozen by fear or indecision, and while he dithered, I slammed serpent breath down on his forearm, with enough force to make him drop the sword. Then, as I passed him, I hammered the back of his helmet. I used the flat of the blade, knocking him forward onto his horse's mane. I was not sure he was stunned, so I slammed the hilt down onto his head, then snatched his horse's bridle and dragged it off the road. Berg, on the road's far side, had thrust his sword into the belly of one horseman and sliced off the sword-hand of another. One of the riders who had been prodding the women with his spear-stave rode at me, his spear levelled, but I could see the fear in his eyes. The violence had started so quickly none of the Norsemen had been ready for a fight, while my men were hungry. I spurred Tintrug again, slammed the spear aside with serpent breath, and then, because he was now too close, punched Serpent Breath's heavy helt into the man's face. I felt his nose break, saw the blood splatter. Then he whimpered as Rathulf, one of my Danes, slid a sword into the small of his back. The man toppled sideways, his spear falling with a clatter onto the roadside stones. "Take his horse," I told Rathulf. The women were shrieking, the children bawling, and an unhorsed man was screaming as Henkel's axe loomed above him. "Take prisoners!" I bellowed over the cacophony. Henkel must have heard me, but still slammed his heavy blade down, and a child shrieked in terror as the fallen man's head was split in two. "Prisoners!" I shouted again, then saw that Ina had somehow recovered and was urging his horse westwards. I dug my heels into Tintrug's flanks, galloped alongside and hit the back of Ina's helmet again, harder still, but again using the flat of my sword. This time he fell from the saddle and I seized his horse's bridle. Berg came to help, dismounting and stripping away the unconscious man's sword belt.
"What about the women, lord?"
he asked. "We can't help them," I said. I regretted that, but we were a small band of warriors in a wide land infested by the enemy. We had to move swiftly or die. I looked back to see that my men had beaten down all the remaining enemy. The suddenness of their attack had won the small fight, but three of the enemy had still escaped and were spurring their horses westwards. We had two prisoners. Ina was one. I dismounted and went to look at the young man whose sword had so nearly wounded me. He was either dead or unconscious. Serpent Breath had opened the back of his helmet as if it were an eggshell, and there was a mess of bone and blood in the ragged gap. I kicked the fallen man in the chest to turn him over, but he showed no sign of feeling the blow. I stooped and ripped off a golden chain that hung at his neck, then took his sword, which had a hilt ringed with gold. I undid his sword belt, tugged it free, and the violence of the tug forced a groan from him. I sheathed the precious weapon and threw it to Rorik. "Look after it. It's valuable." I pulled myself back into the saddle and shouted at Berg to hurry. He had managed to drape Ina over a saddle and was tying his hands and feet to the girth strap. Rathulf was securing the second prisoner, a much younger man, while the women were begging us to take them away. One woman held her baby up to me.
"Take her, lord, take her!"
"We can't take any of you!" I hated telling her that. The best we could do for the women was to give them food we had found in sacks tied to the captured saddles. Three of the women were searching the corpses looking for coins or food.
"Lord, we must hurry,"
Berg said to me. He was right. The three horsemen who had escaped our attack were almost at the western crest of the road. It would not be long before Skull sent men back to punish us. "Are the prisoners secure?"
"Yes, lord."
"Then we go."
"Lord,"
a woman called.
"Please, lord."
It hurt to leave them, but I dared not take them. We kicked our horses off the road and up the slope, leading five captured stallions and the two prisoners. Once over the crest, I planned to go south until I was sure any pursuit had been left behind. Then we would return to the road and hurry back east to Jorvik. We so nearly reached the crest. Our horses were labouring up the heather-thick hillside with only yards to go when Ketil looked back.
"Lord!"
he called.
"Lord!"
I looked behind. Skull's men had turned back, and now there was a line of horsemen on the western spur, and even as I watched, more men joined that line. There were at least 100 men, and at their centre was the big man in the white fur cloak. I turned again as we reached the crest and saw the enemy had started in pursuit. We were being hunted. Chapter 5. My plan had been to ride south, and, once out of sight of the road, turn east towards distant Jofawik. I assumed the women we had left on the road would have told Skull's men they had seen us heading south, and I had hoped that misdirection would be sufficient to send our pursuers towards Mercia while we rode eastwards. But that hope was now gone, because Skull's scouts were already spurring up the slope, and they would soon be close enough to see which way we headed. I had wanted time to escape, and I was being given none. I decided we would go east anyway. "That way!" I shouted at Finan, pointing. I spurred Tintrig to Finan's side. "The bastards are coming after us!" Finan instinctively looked around, but no pursuing horsemen were in sight yet. "What do we do?" "We'll ride east and hope we can get back to the road." I looked up at the still empty skyline. "They can't pursue us forever." "We hope," Finan said dryly. It was my fault. Discovering what had happened in Jofawik could have waited. Nothing I learned here would make the slightest difference to Seatrigger. Either he was alive or he was dead. But I had given way to my impatience, and now I had a small army of vengeful Norsemen pursuing me. The curse was working, I thought grimly. I should never have sought out Beedwulf, but should have ridden straight for home, and now, by attacking Skull's men and taking prisoners, I had made myself the hunted instead of being the hunter. My best hope was that Skull would think I was in the vanguard of a Northumbrian pursuit, and that an army was not far behind me. So far they had only seen a handful of my men, but soon the scouts would see we were over 90 strong. Why pick a fight with us? Skull Grimason would just lose more men. It was a slender hope. I swerved to reach the crest again. I was planning to slant down the hillside to rejoin the road, but when I reached the skyline, I saw Norsemen racing east along the valley. There had to be 50 or 60 of them, and when I turned in the saddle I saw that even more Norsemen had reached the crest and were now following us. 2 bands of pursuers, and the ones below had plainly been sent to get ahead of us. Skull Grimason wanted to trap us. So I turned south to escape his trap. I was fleeing. My men outnumbered the smaller war band racing east along the road, but I had nothing to gain by fighting it. We could have turned back, galloped downhill, and overwhelmed that smaller group, but I would lose men and horses in the fight. Some of my men would be wounded, and I must either abandon them to Skull's mercy or try to carry them with us as we escaped. If we escaped, because the Norsemen and the larger warband were sure to follow and help their comrades. So our only hope was to flee south and pray for nightfall, which was still 2 or 3 hours away. At least the sight of our numbers made the nearest pursuers pause. They outnumbered us, but they had as little to gain from a fight as we did until they were reinforced, and thus certain of defeating us easily. We crossed another crest, and found a cattle track beaten through the heather, and we followed that, going faster now. Ahead of us, the land dropped away, leading to fields, and I could see smoke rising from settlements. Somewhere ahead, a good long way ahead, we would pass into Mercia, but we could expect little help there. Any settler in these farmlands would be Danish, and the Danes who lived in southern Northumbria and northern Mercia had learned to be cautious. "Lord!" Finan called. I turned to see a small group of Norsemen coming fast behind us. They were galloping recklessly, each holding a spear. There were only 8 of them, and what could 8 men do against 90? They could frustrate us, and they did.
They hung back for much of the time, then would gallop forward threateningly, and each time they approached we were forced to turn men around, and as soon as we did, they swerved away to avoid a fight. And each time we stopped and turned, we were slowed down. Again and again they charged, then turned away. And again we were forced to face them, and I knew the larger warbands were not far behind and were getting closer. We needed to go faster, and so I put 20 men under Finan's command and had them ride to the right of the road, and another 20 under Berg's leadership who rode to the left. They took it in turns to face the annoying pursuers, while the rest of us kept moving, and that checked the frustrating threats. I rode beside Ina Eriksson, who had recovered his wits. I had taken a moment to sit him properly in his saddle, though with his hands tied at his back and his ankles lashed to the stirrup leathers. "So, what happened at Jofawick?" I asked him.
"Jofawick?"
He was puzzled because I had used the Saxon name instead of the name the Norse used. "At Jorvik?" Rain dripped from his helmet and his moustache.
"Will I live if I tell you?"
he asked. "You'll die if you don't."
"We lost,"
he said curtly. He ducked beneath a branch and almost lost his balance. We had left the moorland, and the road led through a spinney of stunted willow. As we climbed the gentle pastureland beyond the trees, I looked behind and saw our enemy's large warband was a mile away. But it was getting dark, and they were being cautious, despite outnumbering us. The two pursuing groups had joined, and together they had almost double my numbers. But still they seemed reluctant to fight. I could not see Skoll's white cloak among the distant pursuers, so I guessed he had sent another man to lead the warriors, and he had doubtless told that man to be careful. If Ina was right, then Skoll must have lost men at Jofawick, and he doubtless did not want to lose more. And though he could overwhelm us in a fight, he would pay dearly for our defeat. He had declared war on Sea Trigger. He had lost the opening fight, and I reckoned he needed every warrior to face my son-in-law's revenge. Or so I hoped. The sun was low now and hidden by darkly heaped clouds. The wind gusted rain that had begun to fall steadily. We passed a steading that had smoke coming from the hall roof and was surrounded by a stout palisade. I knew my tired men must hope that I would attack the small farmstead and so give them a refuge with a hearth, but to stop now would be to invite our pursuers to besiege the place, and so we kept going into the wet dusk. "So, you lost," I said to Ina. "How?" He told me the tale as we rode into the darkness. The young warriors who had annoyed us abandoned their pursuit and turned back to join the larger warband that seemed content to have chased us far away from the road across the moors. In the dying light and through the veil of hard rain, I saw they had stopped. I suspected they would demand shelter in the steading we had passed. Ina grudgingly told me that Skoll's best hope of capturing Jofawick had been to move quickly, to cross the wide plain about the city as fast as possible, and so take the garrison by surprise, but he had paused before he left the hills. "Where?" I asked. Ina shrugged.
"Just a settlement," he said. "There was a cave there."
"Why did he stop?"
"Weather. It was cold. It wasn't so cold when we left home. We thought spring had come, but winter came back. It closed in fast."
"You took shelter?"
"We had to. You could hardly see through the blizzard."
"How long did you wait there?"
"Just a day."
A day was not long, but the pause must have been fatal to Skoll's hopes.
"They knew we were coming,"
Einar continued bitterly.
"So someone must have warned them. And the sorcerer told Skoll not to attack the city. At least that's what men said afterwards."
"Doesn't Skoll take his sorcerer's advice?" I asked.
"Usually."
Ina spoke abruptly, as if talking about Skoll's famed sorcerer troubled him.
"So why did Skoll attack?" I asked. "We'd come so far," Ina said,
and Snorri... His voice faded away. "Snorri is the sorcerer?" I asked.
"He is."
"And he told Skoll not to attack?"
"Men said so."
Ina spoke hesitantly, evidently reluctant to discuss the sorcerer.
"But you can't always understand what Snorri says. Sometimes he speaks in riddles."
"But men fear him," I pressed.
"Snorri is terrible,"
Ina said in a low voice.
"When he looks at you?"
I thought Skoll blinded him.
"He did, but Snorri still sees you. He sees the future, and in battle..."
His voice trailed away again. "In battle?" I asked.
"He gazes at the enemy."
Ina's voice was touched with awe.
"And they die."
"That didn't work in Jorvik," I said scornfully.
"Snorri didn't go into the city. Some days he's too weak to summon the gods, but when Snorri is strong, then Skoll always wins. Always! The blind man stares, and the living men die."
A blind sorcerer who could see the future and kill with a glance. So, had Snorri seen me in his dreams? And had he cursed me? I touched the hammer and felt the emptiness that suggested the gods had abandoned me, and I could find no omen in the darkness to give me hope. Most of us had dismounted by now and were leading our horses. The night was thick, wet, and miserable. There was no chance of a pursuit in this foul darkness, even if the men behind us had a mind to keep going, yet still we stumbled on, finally stopping where some winter-bare trees offered an illusion of shelter. I was tempted to light a fire, but dared not. We would just have to suffer through the wet, cold darkness. We tied the two prisoners to a tree. "So what happened when you reached Jorvik?" I asked them.
"They invited us into the city,"
the second captive, a young man called Njal, answered from the dark.
"Invited you?"
He explained that Skoll had sent a small party ahead. Just 30 men, none of them dressed for war but pretending to be travellers.
"They were to say they were looking for a ship to buy," Ina added. "The rest of us waited a couple of miles west of the place."
It was not a bad plan. A handful of men, none in mail, would have hardly looked like a threat to Seatrigger's garrison. Ina said the 30 men had ridden through the village that spread on the Ouse's western bank and crossed the Roman bridge. Then they must have reached the southwestern gate, with its massive stone towers and high fighting platform.
"We know the 30 men captured the gate," Ina said, "because they flew Skoll's wolf flag from one of the towers, and that was the signal for us to follow. Skoll sent his best men first."
"The Ulfhjevna?"
"The Ulfhjevna,"
Ina confirmed, then continued his story.
"Skoll led them, but it was a trap. They let us capture the gate, but the streets beyond were barricaded, and behind the barricades was an army. And when 100 or so were inside the city, another band appeared at the riverbank to cut them off. They made a shield wall to stop the rest of us crossing the bridge, so the men inside the city were trapped."
"And slaughtered?" Finnan put in with relish.
"Most of them, yes."
"Most of them," I repeated the words. "Didn't you say that Skoll was inside the city?"
A gust of wind brought rain spattering down from the branches.
"Skoll," Ina said, "is an Ulfhjeldin.
10 men can't stand against Skoll."
There was awe in his voice.
"He came back through the gate with 20 of his wolf warriors, and they attacked the shield wall, barring the bridge. We attacked too from the other side of the river, and we broke them. We ran the river red with their blood, but by then the city gates were closed."
So Skoll's lunge across Britain had failed. His sorcerer had been right, and the defenders of Jofawik had thwarted him, and so, as recompense for his followers,
He had led them on a rampage through the wide farmlands around the city, taking slaves, plunder, and cattle, and had then started back across the hills to Cumberland.